Welcome to What the Hex, your source for Warhammer Underworlds in under 30 carefully reconsidered cards. I'm your co-host Davey, and with me as always I got Phil. How are you doing tonight, Phil?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good.
All right, and for those of you who've been watching the Facebook feed, you know that we have a special guest on for this episode. We got Aman from Path to Glory and from Hexes and Warbands. Aman, thank you very much for coming on. It's a pleasure to have you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to be here. I was kind of saying this earlier, a big fan of your podcast, so very excited to be here. And yeah, I'm hoping to have some great conversation.
I think so. I think we got some good topics. And once again, listeners have really kind of come out strong, and we're going to be answering a whole bunch of questions. It's kind of formatting most of our episode here. That episode is going to be talking about updating our old decks. So now that we've had a couple things, right? We've had the card rotation, and we're in the new season. We're seeing new universals, and then there's been the new change to the now Forsaken and Restricted list. So we're going to be talking all about that. That's coming up next. In the meantime, we got a little housekeeping to take care of. As always, we give you the context for the episode. We're releasing this. The Forsaken and Restricted list has been out. We still are just sitting on, at this point, Grimwatch have made their big splash, and we're eagerly anticipating those Goblins on Wolves dropping in and running wild. You can always get in touch with us at WTHcast on Twitter, and we'll talk more contact at the end. We're on to community shout-outs. Here, especially because we've got Aman, I wanted to shout-out some of the other podcasts. I think we've kind of been a little remiss in hitting them up. And Aman, since we got you on right here, let's talk this. I've been want to say I really enjoyed your last couple. If you want to listen to the podcast that has the most successful combined players on it, that's you guys. Between you and Jonathan, you've been tearing up the U.S. scene, and it's real good listening. So tell us a little bit about where you're coming at from Path to Glory. For I you know, my assumption is usually that everybody listens to all of them, but if they haven't heard of you, why don't you let them know about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I really appreciate the compliments. We tend to go at a lot of events, so I guess our likelihood of winning them is, I guess, a little bit higher. But we put a lot of hard work and effort into it, and I guess it all kind of started because it's something that I always wanted to do. You mentioned Jeff earlier from Claim the City, and that podcast and combination with yours and Max Bernstein and Randall Slate's Battle for Salvation really inspired me to start my own. And so Jonathan lives in Texas, I live in Texas. Davey, you're originally from Texas.
Yep.
And so we decided to kind of start a Texas-based Warhammer Underworlds podcast, and we focused on three things: competitive gaming, player development, and community growth. We've been leaning a little bit heavier into competitive gaming at the moment just because we've been going to a lot of events. Tournament season has kind of just wrapped up for Night Vault. And yeah, if you're down to listen about the meta, kind of our game experiences and what we think it's going to look like moving forward, I would really hope that you guys listen.
Sure. And I know you talked about, I mean, you're saying now that you're leaning into the competitive play section, but you had an episode a while back on growing your community, and that was one of the most real talk episodes I've heard of any of the Underworlds podcasts in a long time. I really enjoyed that one. There were a lot of good tips and a lot of thoughtful discussion. So,
yeah, I appreciate that. Sometimes it's hard to be a little vulnerable on a podcast when you don't know who's listening and kind of putting yourself out there. But my favorite part about that was, you know, just recognizing that sometimes there's a moment where you have to just step back and grow the community rather than play in it. And Max Bernstein and Jonathan Davis gave me some excellent advice, and I've really taken that to heart, and I've been working really hard to develop the scene in Houston and Austin, two cities that I flirt between with quite often. And so I'm finally starting to see some of those dividends pay out, and I'm really excited for the future of Warhammer Underworlds in those two cities.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to make a return to Texas at some point. I'm always eyeing the calendar for what I can reasonably try to do. But you recently won the Grand Clash at the Warhammer Citadel, and that seems like it might be a pretty fun thing to get to next year. So I'll have to see how things work out. But that might be a fun thing to drop down.
I heard there's supposed to be two every year. So every 6 months.
Nice. Mm-hmm. All right.
So hopefully we'll see you both at one of them, or both.
Sure.
Both might be a stretch.
At the very least, if nothing else, we will all meet at Adepticon, and hopefully roll in some glory. So, but while we're on the topic of other podcasts, I know we've mentioned the Crit Def podcast before. I wanted to give them a particular shout out because if you listened once before, they had great content. The sound quality was still had some room for improvement. Corey has updated their equipment. Man, they sound great. And I was trading some emails with him because I think I need to figure out what he's doing, because whatever it is, he's got some great sound clarity. So if that's something that slowed you down on checking them out again, you should go back, take a look. It's the Crit Def podcast. As of this recording, they're still just on Podbean. They're working on getting onto other platforms, but check them out. The other one, and Aman, I think you know these guys better, so I may throw this your way, but is the Battle Mallet podcast. You met these guys in person. I had not checked them out because my understanding was that they covered a whole bunch of things, and I assumed it was just like sort of a one little corner of the podcast was devoted to Underworlds, but I listened to kind of some of the super episode that you were not on, but it was almost everybody else who was at Nova. That was a pretty fun listen. Awesome guys. Yeah.
No, they're awesome. I had the pleasure of meeting them at Nova, and I really like the narrative behind their podcast. It's just four dads who, when they have time, can get together and play their hobby. And it's their journey through not only navigating through life, but also staying a tight-knit community through games and building that friendship and the relationship off that, and their yearly annual trip to Nova. And I was a bit hesitant at first because, as you mentioned, I didn't know how much Underworlds was a part of it. Mm. But lately, they've been going really strong in it, and I'm very excited to continue listening because I think they're awesome guys and their content is great.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed the episodes I've heard so far. I'm going to do my best to put a link to all these casts in the show notes so that people can check them out. That kind of covers, and then we're not mentioning it, but or I am now, Battle for Salvation, always strong. They are probably by the time you hear this, they'll already be out with their Despoilers episode. I know that's what Max has been working on. He wants some glass with them. That's going to be a great ep to listen to. I know that's a little bit of a controversial warband. I see a lot of people online saying how they think they're terrible and that sort of thing. And I think they're just there's a steep learning curve on them. And so I'm excited to hear that, hear how he's been successful with them. And Aman, you've been successful with them too. And I think people will be able to read about that or hear that from your route. So for people who are checking the Despoilers angle, there's content coming out from multiple directions for that. But our next section before we get onto the main topic for the evening is what the heck is going on with you. And Aman, as the honored guest, why don't you lead us off? What have you been doing in the Underworlds hobby of late?
Yeah, so I've been really enjoying Beastgrave. It's just been almost rejuvenating to play with some of these new warbands and cards. And I've been really tapping into some of my creative juices to build decks and mess around with them and come up with ideas. And a lot of the time they don't work, but man, when they work, right? And so I'm feeling really re-energized to play again. I felt like at the end of Nightfall, it got really stale and repetitive. And so glad that it's a new meta, new environment, new members joining. And just been playing games, and I was fortunate enough to be able to go to two tournaments over the last week and engage with some of my fellow community members, and I was lucky enough to win two local events. I got Shade Glass for both the Grimwatch and the Despoilers, so very excited.
Oof. Just get the Wild Hunt, and you've got Beastgrave completed to date.
They're a bit harder, I think.
Yeah, they. Well, Phil, talking about the Wild Hunt, what have you been up to?
Well, I've been trying to hunt with the Wild Hunt. So far, it's been pretty good, but the updates to the restricted list, I'm going to have to pretty much go back to the drawing board again because I was already down to 20 cards in the deck, and so I can't just pull a few things out and be fine. So we're going to have to figure out a few new things to put in to replace some of those cards that I was relying on. And yeah, just generally, I think try and keep the same spirit of the way the deck was working, but just find a few new tools to fill those slots.
Very cool. I know that you're not too far off from something because you were getting me pretty salty the last time we played, kicking my butt around the place.
Yeah, I've only lost twice with them so far. But both times it was to ghosts, so that's something to consider.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a little weakness there.
Well,
which ghosts?
No. Both, actually. Oof. But they were both being played very aggressively.
All right. For myself, I've been on a crazy flurry of going through season one warbands. So I've played some games with Farstriders, with Magors. I got a little Chosen Axes in. Doesn't count as season one, but got a little bit of the Condemners in a Triumph. And then recently I've been on a little bit of a Reavers kick, and that's been it's always a little bit of a nice nostalgic trip when I get back to the Reavers. So but man, it is different by far than playing with the hold objective ghost that I played for such a long time there. Everything's on like the knife's edge of a few rolls, you know. You feel like you blink and all of a sudden you're out of dudes, or you roll people. So, but yeah, I mean, kind of in the theme of this episode, I felt like a good time to go take a look at some older warbands and see how they were looking. So, well, anybody got anything else they want to throw in there, or we'll jump onto the main topic.
Let's get to it.
Let's do it. All right. So the overview, it's pretty simple. We're going to give you the summary of the most recent changes, and then we're going to jump into the listener questions, which will kind of work us through how we're incorporating these latest changes into rebuilding our shattered decks into the new season and the new meta. So Phil, can you start us off? Just pick some of the most recent changes and give us a rundown, and then we'll just kind of jump in if we find something notable about those. But right now we're just mostly listing them off for you, and we'll come back at them from a different angle in a bit.
Sure. So first off, just as a note, this is going to be specifically talking about the championship play style. So this is going to be restrictions specific to playing in a Grand Clash or similar style event. The other formats that they have going on, there's Alliance, which has the same restrictions, but the deck building's a little different because you're having to build across teams, and then Relic, where you can use a number of cards from all the seasons, but the restricted list is actually different, which I thought was interesting, but that's not the focus of this episode.
Sure.
So high-level changes. We're now down from 5 restricted cards to 3, as I was just mentioning in the deck changes that I was going to need to be making. So they added a new rule for lethal hex placement, where they clarified that placing the lethal hexes can't be adjacent to printed lethal hexes. And I imagine that is to do with situations where people were making huge walls of lethal hexes.
Yeah, and I've seen an interesting side effect of this is that I've now been figuring out how can I place my lethal to try to block off where I think the opponent might place a lethal if there's a spot I especially don't want to. It comes up a lot with diagonal boards. This has been a more interesting change than I initially gave it credit for, but yeah.
Yeah, well, and that's good because, or at least in my opinion, because just like with objective placement, being able to use it in a sort of way of countering your opponent's strategy, now you can do the same thing with lethals, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, then they just so I guess also we've got the limit on surge cards. We kind of already knew about this beforehand, but it's sort of official now. It's in the restricted list of being an official rule for that style of play. And then they updated the list of cards that are restricted, and they changed some for the banned list. And the change there is really just upper hand. Extreme flank stayed, but they moved upper hand from the restricted to banned, which I guess is called Forsaken now. I'm probably not going to get used to that for a little while here, so forgive
absolutely
me if I
not
just say banned all the time. And then I guess a couple other things of note. Fired Up came off the restricted list, so you can use that to your heart's content now. And Archer's Focus also came off, which honestly I think that's a good change. I don't think that card was strong enough to see a lot of play as a restricted card. So seeing it come off is, I think, going to see it show up a little bit in some places again.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Like, am I correct? This is the first time that we've had something come off the restricted list, or am I?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
So yep. That's, and it seems to coincide. It's pretty early in this season, so I think, you know, we'll keep our eyes open, but we'll see what we think is happening with, you know, maybe as we enter new seasons each time, they may be taking in a look. But I don't know. I like the idea that things can go on and come back off the restricted list, depending on what else is in the card pool, which just makes sense to me. So,
yeah, for sure.
I'd like to say that I'm very, very happy that Upper Hand is now Forsaken or banned.
Yeah.
I hated that card for numerous reasons. Most importantly, and I'll keep this succinct, is that it's a negative play experience regardless to who's playing it. So if you don't roll a tie roll, the person who has it is upset. And the person who, for example, maybe needed a double crit to get out of a real dicey situation, no pun intended, and then rolls a double crit, and then the other person says, well, I have Upper Hand, so that cool feel-good moment that you just had that's one in a million that you were going to tell your friends about, yeah, you're not going to tell your friends about it anymore.
Well, they'll still tell their friends about it. It's just going to be a very different story.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess I wanted it to be more positive, right?
Sure. A
bit more cursing, probably.
Yeah. Well, and I like it just from the, because you always kept on ending up in this awkward moment of like, I just slowed games down where you'd be, okay, well, I'm going to roll my dice, my defensive dice. I know you missed, but I guess I'm going to roll this just in case you have Upper Hand, because I don't want you to have to signal whether you do or don't have it. Or the converse would happen where they would not roll their defense and you have to be like, hey, bud, do you mind you mind just picking up some defensive dice for no particular reason and rolling it? So just from a game flow perspective, I appreciate that change. So
I think it's really funny, though, that it did promote proper play in a way, because you're supposed to roll defense.
Yeah.
But most people just don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's going to cut corners to save time. So, I mean, it's kind of one of those interesting side effects of human nature, right?
Yeah. And then before we jump into questions, what are your guys' thoughts about the move to three restricted? What do you think the impetus is behind that, and what do you think that signals for the future?
I like it in that it's going to force some hard decisions. I think in certain decks, at least in the end of Season 2, I didn't really feel like I had to choose that hard between restricted cards. I usually had enough that I liked to go to that it was kind of like, well, there's my five. I don't really need to think about this. Now with three and having a smaller card pool, I think it's going to make for some interesting choices. And I think it also shows that they're probably going to try and have fewer cards restricted, but make it more impactful for a card to be restricted, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I'd like to echo that. I do think that the deck building changes are nice. My assumption would be that, you know, if you look at a lot of the cards they added to the banned and restricted list previously in Nightbolt, they were to curb certain styles of play. And then with all those cards that left from the shift from the Season 1 Universals, a lot of those changes that the design team or whomever makes the list, you know, changed, was kind of reverted back, because Molag could take Burst of Speed, Long Strider, Acolyte of the Cataphranes, Upper Hand, and Tome of Offerings. And the whole point of putting those cards on there was to kind of curb that appetite. Conversely, you could take Well of Power, Sphere of Akshi, Tome of Offerings, Upper Hand, and then whatever else you needed with the Curse Breakers to kind of, again, do that really heavy magic style of play, which was specifically mentioned or targeted in one of the banned and restricted list updates. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great change. I think it brings that power level back into equilibrium almost. And I think the warbands that benefit the most from it are actually the Season 1 warbands, because now it comes down to, yeah, you can take Pit Trap, you can take whatever cards you want, but there's more of a fighting chance, I think. And I really like that.
Yeah, I think you're both 100% correct. And I agree, Phil. I think they may be signaling that their expectation is that they may have bracketed in what the target card power is. And so I don't think this, I don't think it means we won't ever see another restricted, but I think they may be feeling confident that they won't have to restrict so many. And just when season one left, we lost so many off the restricted list by them rotating out. That I think the change made sense. But all right, so we are going to get into listener questions here. They're kind of structuring our episode for us. We're kind of answering this from the context of building decks, whether we're rebuilding old decks or taking a look at a warband that we haven't been thinking about for a while and seeing what we might want to build. And our first question is coming in from Jimmy Molini, who Aman has had a drink or two with. Got to see him at Gen Con, and he's pointing out what I thought was something that I've noticed a lot as I am working my way through some of the season one warbands, especially the slower ones. And he's pointing out that some speed has left the game. He says, "I feel like warbands with base 3 movement and range 1 attacks keep losing ground in this game, especially considering all the newer warbands seem to have high movement. And if you look at all the Beastgrave warbands, we're looking at speed 4 or 5 or 6, you know, on depending on how inspired they are." He says, "One card that was a great help to these 3-move warbands was Spectral Wings, and now that that's rotated out and then Hidden Paths is gone, there's a loss of speed." So we're going to kind of come at this. Are you feeling that same thing? And then his side prop to that is, do you think Spectral Wings should be a universal card in each season's box set, kind of like Sidestep has been so far? Aman, you want to kick us off with that?
Yeah, most certainly. So yeah, know Jimmy pretty well. Corn cares not. But so I think there's validity in what Jimmy is saying. I do feel like the game is getting faster in terms of movement and speed, and I think the importance of that and the relevance of that is more apparent now more than ever, I think, because we're relying more on warband and faction cards rather than the universal pool because it's so short or small. Mm-hmm. I think the problem or the challenge, I would like to challenge some of that with, if you have 3 movement, there's a reason behind it, right?
Yeah.
You have 4 wounds probably, or you maybe have some great defense dice. So there's strengths and weaknesses to everything. But I do feel like warbands like the Curse Breakers or the Iron Skulls Boys or even the Chosen Axes, which I think are all, I guess, pretty decent right now, do suffer. Because warbands like Skaven, Grimwatch, Despoilers, Wild Hunt can run circles around them. I don't know if Spectral Wings should be a universal card just because I feel like people got used to it and they relied on it so much and it affected the way that they played the game. And so whether there's a card like that in the future, I mean, I'm sure I'd love to have it, but I would really like to see maybe more unorthodox strategies that don't necessarily revolve around movement, maybe rely on other things like pushes or control or even push denial.
Sure. To that effect, I think Spectral Wings was especially powerful. It'd be cool if we saw some, something that was similar but had some caveat to it, right? Like, so +2 speed, but you have to take a damage to do it, or, you know, +1 speed for a normal guy, +2 for a leader, or something like that. You know, just Spectral Wings. I'm not saying Spectral Wings was too powerful, but I think by existing, it kind of sealed off some of the design space for other cards. So with it gone, it'd be interesting to see what mobility cards pop up to take its place.
Yeah, I think maybe being a quarry could be one of the side effects, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Be a quarry for the rest of the phase. Phil, any thoughts on that? Or we kind of got that one in the bag there.
I generally agree with everything that's been said. I would say maybe with Hidden Paths that I think we can all agree that that kind of card was too good because everyone was using it. And mm-hmm. I think Spectral Wings almost borders on that same area where it's not ever going to be a bad choice. And so it's almost going to show up more than you'd like it to. And so I agree. I think finding ways to add movement that's not just like, hey, let's boost stats because it's kind of obvious. I think that's things like, what's the one you teleport between? You switch two fighters that are on objective X's. I can never remember the name.
Confusing reflection. There's a whole bunch that are
shifting
like
reflection.
Shifting reflection. Yeah. There it is. But so I think more things like that, where you get a lot of movement, but the setup, you have to like plan for it because, you know, just like I'm going to push, you know, my speed up by two. That's really straightforward and really strong. And so I think I like the idea of having to plan for your movement, although at least from like the hunt, they're so fast that it's kind of like, well, they do have something of an advantage, but I think that's baked into their design. They're supposed to be really fast. So similar to Iman's point, it's kind of like you have three move for a reason, and that might be part of like maybe they're just not going to be fast and you just have to build around that.
Sure.
All
right. Let's talk about something that I think everybody needs to be keeping in mind when they're building a deck these days, and this is Grimwatch. And Steven was asking, how have the Grimwatch influenced your choices in deck building? Phil, have you gotten a game against the Grimwatch yet?
No, I haven't gotten to play against them yet, though I'm looking forward to it. Okay. I definitely have been thinking about it, although I think given the way I've been playing recently, it's not anything that's going to affect my play style. I was already being fairly aggressive, but being able to get a lot of movement through cards. So if I needed to make like a last ditch move somebody in to deny inspiration, that wouldn't be terribly hard. But I think for a lot of decks, it could be very difficult. And that's sort of the interesting proposition that Grimwatch adds to the game, right? You have to plan a different strategy than maybe you want, because if you don't stop them, they're going to get scary.
Sure. Yeah. They go from challenging to super challenging. Iman, you have played against and won glass with the Grimwatch. So what's your take on how Grimwatch is impacting deck building right now?
I think there's a huge impact from the Grimwatch when it comes to deck building. I think at this point in time, they are, I don't want to scare people and say they're like Malog level, but I do think that objective play in general is so strong and the Grimwatch do it so well that you have to tech for that. So whether it's make, you know, throwing in some push cards or denial cards or maybe cards like I think Restless Prize, where you move the objective twice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's paramount, because at this point in time, especially with cards like Swift Capture and Path to Victory, objectives are important, whether it's for you or your opponent, especially if they're Grimwatch, or for both of you. And if you don't have cards that can deny that or help you get onto them, which further denies the Grimwatch's play, then I think you're in for a tough time.
Yeah, I think it's really salient that you mentioned Malog. I think similar to how in Night Vault, if you're going to play competitively, you needed to have an idea of what am I going to do if I face Malog? Am I going to try and kill him? Am I going to try and avoid him? Am I going to try and go kill the squigs? Like, what's my plan? You need to have a plan for Grimwatch, and you need to know, like, is my plan to stop them inspiring, or is my plan to, you know, go hard into my own game plan and try and beat them out that way. So whatever way you're going, you need to know what your plan is if you face Grimwatch, because they're going to be out there. But Iman, you mentioned Path to Victory, and this is a dual end phase objective, two glory. If you're sitting on two objectives and have taken an enemy fighter out of action in the previous action phase, and that brings up what play styles we think are coming up. And specifically here, Chris Spark was asking which deck archetypes have been hit hard and what new archetypes may be on the rise. To that point, I'm thinking flex. Like this is a almost an centerpiece to a flex deck, because you, this card by definition means that you have taken fighters out of action and you are holding objectives. In my mind, I think that it's never been a better time to examine whether the warband you are interested in playing could play in a flex style.
I could not agree more. If your warband can do more than one thing well, you're good. And if they can't, I think you're at a serious disadvantage.
And I think that all of this is maybe dancing around something that I wanted to just throw out there, is that there's like a renaissance of objective play, and I'm so happy for it, because it used to just take such a side, you know, unless you were playing Thorns, objective play was almost an afterthought. And now if you're not considering it, you're probably losing games. And so I think that's really interesting that there's been such a dramatic shift with just the introduction of just a few cards. But I will definitely agree that, like, you, if you're going pure aggro or pure control anymore now, or even just pure objectives, your opponent might be able to pivot and change their play style where you can't, and that could be hard. And I think especially where that could be really difficult is with control play, where your expectation is that I'm going to, you know, passively earn glory and avoid fighting my opponent or keep them at bay. And I think warbands like Grimwatch and some others just won't let you do that, because they're going to be like, okay, fine, I'll still just do what I want and score a whole bunch of glory.
Yeah, I agree here. The it's hard to say. So I've played against, if we're talking flex, I've played against real power. Grimwatch has a lot of powerful flex. I think they may be the Ur deck for flex play. But I've seen it from Goblins. I've seen it from Thorns. The control that I've seen, Molog still has a Tomes build that he may be able to leverage. And so the question is whether he can rack up enough glory doing that. And I'm not sure that he can. Certainly he can't do it and feel super comfortable that he's going to make it happen. But talking about this, even if you're going aggro, you're paying attention to objectives now. Like, there was a time when we all remember this, when it was, I get to place three objectives. I'm placing as many as I possibly can into the opponent's territory to give me more landing spots for Fainway Crystal. That's not the case anymore. Like, you don't know if your opponent is going flex, you don't want to be giving him extra objectives. And so I think that's been a really interesting change that I've been excited to see. So
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned Fainway Crystal. I found that it's just not as good as it was before.
Absolutely.
People are always on objectives now, right?
I've totally found that.
It's more of like a win more card than anything.
Yeah. And then here's the other problem, is that there has been a, with even just with the loss of distraction, there are fewer, it's not as easy to push somebody off of that. And we'll talk more about that. But yeah, I keep on putting an index and then taking it back out. So I think you need to have a very specific plan about if you're going to include Fainway. It's not as easy as it once was. That's a great point. Let's talk about glory targets. Jared Johnson, Battle Mallet, right, wants to know. So he says, prior to the rotation, the surge limit, many people strove to have at least 16 glory in their objective deck, and you could at the time you could build a deck that was pretty reliable. You could be pretty confident you're going to score most of it. What do you think? What is the glory that you're shooting for right now? And do you feel like you're building your objective decks where you say, I'm expecting to score most, if not all, of my deck out? Aman, you want to take that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So I generally was shooting for 16 glory for some time. And I think John Winrees from Can You Roll a Crit shared with me that he doesn't leave the house without 17 base glory, whether that includes an objective that requires an elimination or not. And I really took that to heart. Back in Nightbolt, you kind of stick to that 15 to 16 range, because if you had a bunch of surges and you ramped up, you can just start steamrolling your opponent with that upgrade advantage, right? But now I think it's super paramount that you have a certain base glory that you can rely on, because if you aren't able to passively score or follow your game plan, then you're going to struggle, and I don't think you'll be able to compete. And that's particularly what makes Grimwatch so good, is that they'll outscore you whether you fight them or not. And so I think thinking about making sure that no matter what, as long as I can draw X number of cards, I can score X number of glory, and identifying that and finding some consistency, again, is paramount. Otherwise, you are going to lose to warbands, especially objective-based warbands who have cards like Supremacy and keep them guessing and things like that.
Sure, 100%. And to exactly that point, I found games against the Grimwatch where I'll take down the Duke, I'll take down, what's the great sword's name? Gristlewell. I'll take down the Duke, I'll take down Gristlewell. I'll have done some serious damage. I'll be rolling around in their territory. I'm like, okay, this game is well in hand. And then I glance over the glory and I'm trailing by one. I'm like, what is happening? How is this possible? And it's because they have that high glory ceiling and they're scoring it all along the way. And so even if you're killing them, you're devoting so many resources to that. So Amon, are you still shooting for 16 glory? Is that where you feel like you're still at?
I generally aim for at a minimum 16, but I always try to get to 17, if not 18, 19. That's the sweet spot.
Sure. Phil, how about you?
I obviously, yes, you want to build your deck to have the maximum that you think is achievable. Obviously, just like stuffing your deck and having like, hey, I can score 22 base glory. It's like, yeah, but you're never going to actually do that because they're all score three cards or something crazy that you won't achieve. I think that's a good like baseline to have, but I guess ultimately in the games that I've been playing, the like ability to pivot and adjust to your opponent's play style feels more important than ever, in that if your game plan can score a lot but your opponent's game plan can score more, it doesn't matter. You need to have some way to answer to what they're doing. Whether that's clogging up their objective game or, you know, killing them faster than they can kill you or whatever that happens to be. And so I guess ultimately it's like, well, I want to score one more than my opponent, but that's kind of that answer doesn't quite get to the core of it. So, I think denial is more important than ever, more so than being able to just get your numbers, if that makes sense.
Sure. Makes sense. We're going to move on to the next thing. I do want to give a tip of the hat to Paul Steiner, who was thinking along the same lines, was asking some of the same things about the glory caps and such. And also, I personally want to give a nod to Paul, who just kicks my teeth in every time we play. So thanks for that, Paul. We're going to talk a little bit later about specific warbands. I feel like I want to hop on to talking about specific cards, and we'll spin back around to warbands in a bit. Let's talk about, as you're going through, as you're assessing what you're going to include in your deck, what are the things that you're valuing right now in your cards? Like, what characteristics as you go through, you say, I'm looking for this kind of resource. Does this warband have it? Do they have it innately? Are there universals I can get? So talk to me, Phil. We're going to go back to you. What are some of the resources? What are some of the things you're valuing when you're looking through, maybe through some faction cards that you haven't seen in a while, or through some of the universals that you have to re-examine now that the old standbys aren't there anymore?
So I think, and we kind of already touched on this, but movement. Whether that's through pushes or other ways to get extra moves, extra actions, just getting around the board's not quite as easy as it used to be. And so finding those ways to still get that mobility, I think, is super important. And then personally, after mobility, I've been focusing more on accuracy than focusing on damage or survivability, because we're seeing a lot of the new warbands don't hit as hard with before they have upgrades anyway, so survivability early in the game doesn't feel as important. Accuracy means that I don't have to worry about my dice rolls as much. and I think anything that's gonna help you rely on dice more, or have your dice be more reliable in a game where people are getting more and more glory that doesn't require dice rolls, is going to be super important if you are going to go the aggro route.
Sure. Aman, what are you valuing when you're flipping through cards?
Yeah, so every deck I make focuses on, I guess, three things, right? Is, as Phil mentioned, mobility and accuracy, the latter being very important to me. I like to play warbands that are interactive, and I like to shoot things, especially with my profiteers. So I definitely like it when my attacks hit, especially if you're running Tome of Offerings. One thing that I'm a really big fan of now, but I think it's really hard to come by at the time being, is push prevention.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of push cards that are great, but like Mirror Move, for example, is fantastic, right? Because twofold. You can actually play two steps forward, push two of your fighters, have your opponent push a fighter, and then you can react with the Mirror Move and push your fighter when they push their fighter, which is fantastic. Furthermore, a Mirror Move also kind of works in that defensive reaction standpoint where you can actually block Pit Trap. So if your opponent pushes you back during an attack action, you can just Mirror Move and you've just denied their Pit Trap, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, well, and I found exactly this is, I've been using Mirror Move myself, and it has some crazy use. Every so often it sits in your hand, like against a control deck who may not be doing a lot of pushes. Sometimes it's just stagnated in my hand. On the other hand, you know, sometimes somebody hits you with a knockback attack, hits one of your fighters, and you turbo boost another fighter up two hexes, and it can really change the scope of the game. And it can capitalize. There's some really powerful push cards in the new warbands, like Vile Invaders and Hunt in Concert. And then is it Pack Advance? Is that the Grimwatch one that sends a bunch of ghouls, two hexes?
Two ghouls, two hexes.
Yeah. So it capitalizes well on those. For me, I was finding, and this is as I was playing Farstriders early on, I was finding that between Snare, between Pit Trap, and between Lethals everywhere, getting pushed back was real bad. So I agree on the push prevention. So then you start looking at some of these cards like... there's a Become a Quarry and Be on Guard. That's something instinct.
Stephen Van wrote an article on that card, right?
Yeah, I think so. It was a
What is that called?
Step to that was the side.
A great article. It really opened my eyes on the card for sure.
Sure. That's what makes that one of my favorite blogs, is that he'll crack down the numbers, and so you realize that not only, I mean, I was valuing it just for the fact that guard was preventing you from being pushed, but it turns out the defensive benefits are right in line with adding an extra dice if you're a dodge fighter and such. So, but what I was finding is that if you can freeze out the after an attack, or if you can find a way to keep yourself from being pushed, so like aggressive defense will prevent a push, which will stop Snare, it'll stop Pit Trap, it'll stop you getting hit into a lethal. So what you can do is say, that's fine, you're an accurate fighter, so you're probably going to hit me anyway, and you're counting on these damage boosts with your gambits or with lethals to get the job done. I'm gonna let you hit me, but I'm gonna get a free attack out of this. That I found powerful. I found the after an attack action can freeze out some important things. So pretty interesting. But like you said, hard to come by with these with some of these. And then on that same thing, we're talking about if I'm talking about aggressive defense, always keeping an eye out now that Ready for Action has left the game. Anything that's giving you extra actions is at an added premium. And this might be as simple as make an attack after you missed an attack, right? So we can see that in Storm Sires. They've got one of those. Thorns have it. The Ghosts have it. So a number of warbands have that. That's basically, I mean, often I used Ready for Action exactly like that, as just insurance in case I missed the attack that I really wanted. So they're almost doing the same thing there. But then there's some other less obvious ones, like with the with the Reavers, there's Fueled by Slaughter, where if a fighter is killed by a ploy or attack action, you can make an attack action with one of your guys. That's been some pretty interesting extra attacks in there. So that's something else I'm generally keeping an eye out. And you'd be surprised how many of those are out there that you have kind of forgotten about. The Sepulchral Guard have two, right? Necromancer commands, and there's another one where if somebody else makes an attack, then somebody else can. One fighter makes one, then somebody else makes one. So
I think orcs have one too, like having a good time.
Yeah, it's a yep. It's a 50-50, but it doesn't have any restrictions on it other than that, which is which is not too shabby. So we've talked a little bit about this. Tristan had a question for us with that 3-card restriction for decks. Do you feel like it's meant certain death for certain cards on the restricted list? Do you feel like you're going to the same 3 all the time, and that there's some that are left behind, or do you feel like that whole list is pretty open?
I actually think I agree with Tristan in that there might be a certain death for cards, because the choice is so, as Phil was alluding to earlier, it's just so cutthroat. You have to pick 3. And why wouldn't you take 3, right? So at the moment, my go-to are Calculated Risk, Pit Trap, and Sudden Growth. I think there is an argument for Tome of Offerings as well as Spirit Bond. I don't really think I would invest in the magic ones personally, but I think if you're not picking at least 2 of those ones I mentioned, then I'd be really interested to see what your strategy is.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I'm in the same boat where my default has been Calculated Risk, Pit Trap, and Sudden Growth. And then if it's going to be something else, like that's where I start. And then I have to have a reason to switch off of that. Now, one reason might be like with the Forest Riders, only starting with 12 health, Calculated Risk felt like a little bit too much of a hit, especially with Speed 3. It meant that I was having to be so close to lethals right off the bat and have them kind of in play. I feel like that's where you're starting. But then there's certain other deck types, like Molog is probably not taking any of those. He's probably going with Burst of Speed, Longstrider, and then if he's a Tome, then Acolyte, and then, or if he's not, then something else. So I think certain deck types will take a look at other spots in the restricted. Phil, are you finding the same?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that, like, I think for the same reason that you'd bring Pit Trap, you can still bring Sphere of Akshi. It's just only going to show up in those magic heavy decks. So it gives you this similar effect of adding extra damage, but you're getting another spell out of it, and an easy to cast one at that. I think Sorceress Flourish is probably one that you're never really going to see, because it sort of dilutes the number of spell cards you're going to have, and is doing something that another card could already be doing, but it's more restricted. So I think that's the only one that I'm looking at and thinking just outright I would never probably put it in. I think there are niche situations for some of the others, but yeah, I think for most decks, it's going to be somewhere in the Sudden Growth, Calculated Risk, Pit Trap, Spirit Bond type of arena.
I think the other thing that Sorcerer's Flourish struggles with is that it plays counter to some of the objectives that you're likely running. Like, it's going to not do the trick for you if you're trying to score Strange Demise.
Yeah.
Or Sorcerer's Scouring. So it's weirdly counterintuitive for some of those. And as other damaging spells are restricted, it gets harder for it to have room to come out. So Aman, you talked about this a little bit earlier, talking about the universal card pool is smaller, and it's smaller for a couple of reasons. It's smaller because we've rotated all of season 1 out, and we've only got part of season 3, but it's also smaller because of the we had 437 cards in Shadespire. And we have, it looks like, 438 cards in Beastgrave, except of those 438, there's a greater percentage of them are faction-specific, because they are releasing each faction with 12 objectives, 10 gambits, and 10 upgrades, which I think is great. But what we're looking at is, even when we get to the end of season, our universal pool will be smaller. How much do you think that's impacting deck building, having that smaller universal pool? Do you think it's changing the value of the universal card pool? And do you think it's affecting some war bands more than others?
Yeah. So I think, you know, obviously you'll see like a major shift in every season. I think when it comes to the season one universals, I don't think it pertains much to the season three warbands as they were, what I would assume, designed without these cards in mind. But the problem, or rather challenge with season one universals, was that they were busted. They were just too strong. They did a lot. You got a lot of mileage out of each and every card. So that's why every deck, especially in season one, felt like it was the same, because you were taking the same like 17 cards. And I think there's a little question as to like why there wasn't much of variety in season one, because again, everyone was taking the same cards, and so it just came down to who had the better faction cards. Even in season two, everyone was taking these same cards: Hidden Path, Spectral Wings, Cover Ground, Ready for Action. So now I think the shift is better, because factions will now have to rely on their faction specific cards more than ever, which personally I'm a fan of, because there's more flavor, there's more uniqueness to every warband. And I think the important thing is that there will always be strong cards that fit with your warband's intended innate strategy. And personally, that seems fun to me. I don't think that we'll miss the Season 1 warband, or Universals, excuse me, too much, because I think, again, Season 2 and what I've seen from Season 3 so far further accentuate your game plan but don't necessarily dictate it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what other people do and experiment with and innovate with. Because right now, I think it's a buff to older warbands. Like you mentioned Chosen Axes earlier. I have yet to win glass with them, and I'm really excited to see how I can kind of tinker with those guys.
So I'll take a quick side note onto Chosen Axes, and it would be great for us to maybe pull in Zach Newcomb or something for an episode doing a deep dive on them. What they have an amazing set of gambits. They have a lot of pretty strong upgrades. It's their objectives where they're struggling a bit, and that's what I have found with my playing. And so that's an example of a warband that says, I'm not too worried about what else is out there in the universals when it comes to upgrades to a lesser extent, and especially to gambits. But they are really on the hunt. I think there are a few objective cards away from really being especially powerful, and I think it'll be interesting to see what else drops and see if those two or three objectives that they're probably looking for come in and let them really unlock. Phil, you got any thoughts about the universal pool?
I think it's good, and I think that, well, right now it might feel a little rough just because we're right at the beginning of season three, and some of the warbands that do need a little bit more universal help, like Sepulchral Guard, Eyes of the Nine, that you might be feeling like, I just don't have the tools I need. I think one or two more warband releases, there'll probably be enough universals that you won't be feeling that anymore. And I also agree that like having the uniqueness to each warband is going to be nice, in that it's like, okay, I don't have to worry that there's going to be Escalation and Alone in the Darkness and, you know, all these super samey cards showing up everywhere because they worked for everyone. And I think, and it may be too early to say, but honestly, in my deck building, I haven't felt that I need to lean into universals all that much to really feel like my deck is good. There's a few things that I'll pull in and be like, yeah, this really fits the style that I'm going for. But otherwise, I don't need to fill out my deck a lot. And I like that because it means that there's probably not going to be as many universals that are viewed as being overpowered, and that kind of circles back on our potential for there to be fewer restricted cards going forward.
All right, well, let's talk about we had one more from Jeff Osborne, and he's talking about the pace of the game, and I feel like it's getting pulled in a couple different directions here. His thoughts were, it feels like they want all 12 activations to be interactive, exciting, and not just have games decided in the first 4 to 6 activations. And I think what he's talking about here is by trimming down Surge, by getting rid of Upper Hand, you're making it so that the game isn't so intensely lethal and snowbally at the start. I mean, this is by nature a game that snowballs, and you're trying to get that snowball going. But do you feel like you guys have seen that, or do you think that's an accurate assessment of what the game feels like right now?
I think so, but I think that it can still very much be decided in the first few actions, because of how quickly glory can be scored right now. I know there have been a couple of games where all of a sudden it'll be like, oh, my opponent scored, you know, supremacy and some other stuff with objectives. And it's like, that's a potential turn of a 7 glory swing. And all of a sudden the game feels very out of reach. And that may not be the case, but even just having that feeling of all of a sudden being behind by like 5 or 6 can really have a psychological impact. So, well, I'll say that I think the snowballing, like, you're not going to feel necessarily like you're out of a game because you got blown up right away on the first round all the time. But I think it's still very possible with a bad draw that you could get behind by enough right now that you could effectively still feel that, and potentially in a way that didn't involve dice rolls, and that's potentially going to feel worse, but I think it'll happen less often.
I'd actually like to comment on that.
Yeah, go for it.
So I actually really like what you said, Phil, in that the psychological effect of snowballing. I think that's huge. Yesterday I played a game, and I scored all of my objectives before the end of the second activation playing Grimwatch. And, like, that's crazy, right? Like, a warband shouldn't be able to do that.
Back up. You scored all your, like, all 12 of your objectives before the end of the second activation?
Sorry, did I say activation or round?
He said round.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I said round. Yeah.
All right.
That would have been crazy, but no, it was the round, which I still think is pretty aggressive, right? Yeah. I agree with your input that it is a snowbally game by nature. And while I do think that you'll still see games decided in the first four to six activations, I think the chance for an opponent to come back now is greater. There's just so many tools in factions, especially some of the newer ones, in which you can really, maybe not necessarily win the game, but cut that glory differential to be bright shorter than your opponent may have foreseen. And so I generally like the direction the game has moved, but I still think that you're going to see some of those snowbally games, and some matchups are just like that, and you can't control it.
It's been, I feel like the games I've played, exactly that. Like, I don't feel like, you know, sometimes they get out of hand, but especially with the new warbands, I feel like games where I think I've got a solid lead, that lead will evaporate rapidly. So I like the feeling, and I remember having this sensation earlier, like early in season 1, where it felt like, hey, play this out, because there might be a comeback in the making. So since we're talking about specific cards, and Aman, you've already talked about this card, but Shubi, he says, Restless Prize, why shouldn't it be in every deck? Even if not playing objective play, it's an awesome counter and a utility card. Then there's special combos you can do if you're running Faneway or Shifting Reflection. Aman, since you've already touted the benefits of Restless Prize, I'll let you take this one.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So Shubi, quick answer, I think it should be in every deck. Objectives matter now, as I mentioned earlier, whether it's for you or your opponent, most likely both of you. Taking advantage of moving an objective and potentially even negating one of your opponent's activations is huge. I listened to your episode with Dean recently, actually this morning, and one thing that he mentioned was that action economy, right? And removing or negating 10%, close to percent of your opponent's action economy is huge. Furthermore, you can do some really funny things, like you mentioned. Like, you can Shifting Reflections an opponent into your zone and then restless prize to where they can't get out. And then now you can just dogpile in on them. Or conversely, you can get a fighter out of there. So I think there's a lot of great uses for it. And even if you're playing an aggro warband, you need to deny the objectives.
Absolutely. And if you've got, like you said, like Chubby's saying, with the right tech, you can find ways to capitalize on that above and beyond. Let's talk a little more generally here. We're going to a quick round table here. Matt Martin is asking, what's an end phase card that you would have never taken before there was the limit of six surges, or we'll say before this rotation? So come up with a card that you would never play before, but you're considering now, or you've been playing now. Phil, you got anything that fits the bill here?
And this is just third end phase cards?
End phase or third end phase, either way.
Okay. Maybe more of what he's probably thinking about. I've liked Hoarder, although I actually just started using it. Thanks, Jeff Osborne, for turning me onto this card a little bit right before the rotation. But I think post-rotation, I like it even more, although you do have to plan for it in your deck quite a bit, because needing 9 unspent glory is not something that usually just happens by accident unless you've already blown the doors off that game. But there'll be some interesting third rounds where sometimes I'll be down by like 7 and I can manage to win the game still because I can pick up 4 or 5, get to having 9 unspent, and then get an additional 3. And have some fun surprise last rounds. But another one that maybe is a little more obvious, but really wasn't, at least I wasn't using it after it moved into the restricted, was Fired Up, because there was just too many other things that I wanted to do, and it was too slow by comparison to some of the easy to score surge cards. But now that we have a restriction on surge cards and it's not restricted anymore, it's a pretty easy pickup. And since you're going to have some easy pickups from end phase cards, I think it's going to be a nice one if you have an easy inspiration mechanic.
I think that's a great point. I also, and you and I were on the same conversation with Jeff Osborne, so not surprising that we're both considering Hoarder. I found it have a chance. It gave me a chance to sometimes keep pace with some of the, prolific scoring from Grimwatch. On the other hand, drawing it early, it's not like Superior Tactician was, where draw it early, that's fine, I'm just going to carry it with me because I'll burn through enough score immediately to get it. It's a lot more painful to draw early. But to your point, I'm going to more generalize off of Fired Up. I think there's been a little bit of a rise with the one glory end phase cards. I've been looking at a whole lot more of those that I had not looked at before, and some of those might be, I much more, I would take in solid gains before, but I look at it a lot more strongly now, because there's just a dearth of other things. Like you said, the spot that gets filled by Fired Up for one glory, that used to be occupied by maybe Escalation, an end phase for two glory. Those aren't available anymore. So one glory in the end phase used to be kind of, man, I have to be desperate to be going after that. Now, now I think there's, at least for now, there's a place for those. Aman, have you been looking at any particular cards?
Yeah. Yeah, so I really like the idea of Denial and Conquest, but I found through, unfortunately, trial and error, more of the error, really, is that they don't really work, I think, and they're really predictable after game one.
Yeah.
One card that I found for some of the warbands who are struggling with some of the end phase cards is Catching Up. I think there are some really... And it's kind of funny, actually, because I think there are a lot of warbands that just naturally score glory faster, while others score glory later in the game. It's their natural process. And I think Catching Up really helps. And there's ways in which you can be cheeky in the way that you score it. So just make sure you score it first if you're going first, if they have more. Or maybe take second turn if you have it in your hand, just so you can ensure you score it.
Sure. And I think to that point, it's maybe even a more handy card for a warband that is a lower fighter count. So you have, at least in that first round, a better chance of going second. Thus, if you have it in hand, you're more likely to get a chance to score it. I experimented with it in, actually, I should say not my deck, but, again, shout out once again to Jeff Osborne. I was using his Condemners deck and he had included it in there, and, I didn't like it, when I looked at it. And then when I played with it, I thought a lot more highly of it. So, and that's kind of the cool spot we're in right now is, discovering the utility on cards that we haven't been all that wild on before. Here's another one, another round table. This is from the man, the myth, the legend, the Godsworn Hunt personified Tom Bond. He wants you, if you can pick one season one objective, ploy, and upgrade to reprint, what would you reprint, and why are you picking those? And I'm going to kick this one off. Well, actually, we'll say Tom's choices were Spectral Wings, Pure Carnage, and Cunning Duelist. Spectral Wings for reasons we already talked about. Pure Carnage because it gave a boost to those pure aggro decks. And then Cunning Duelist, which if you don't remember, because why would you? Because no one used it. It was instead of driving somebody back, you can swap position. So it's like a built-in confusion, which with Shortcut in the game would be pretty interesting as well. But he specifically brings it up for the value that objectives now hold that they didn't before necessarily.
Hmm.
For me, I was thinking Alone in the Darkness just because I liked the sort of mini game there. I liked that you could surprise somebody with it, but then unlike, I felt like with Denial that was easily countered, with Alone in the Darkness, you'd have to make some active sacrifices sometimes to deny it. For my Gambit, man, I loved Illusory Fighter so much. I'm sad I don't get to play with that anymore. Conversely, maybe Mischievous Spirits would be very interesting in the current meta with objectives being as important as they are. You might see it in every deck if it came in. I'm not sure. And then I really liked Lightfooted as an upgrade, and that was the if an opponent can drive you back at the end of an attack action, and instead of them driving you back, you can push. So I kept looking. I was like, surely this exists somewhere. And it does, but it's fighter restricted. So Garrick's got Ever Advancing, and Riptooth has Unshakable, which do the same thing, but they're limited to that one fighter, which makes them less palatable. Aman, give me your three, your objective, your gambit, and your upgrade that you would... You wouldn't mind seeing reprinted.
Yeah, so from a Gambit perspective, I really like Quick Advance. I think pushes are king. I think there is a downside. Your leader has to be alive.
Sure.
And other than that, I mean, I just generally like it. I think cards like that provide a lot of options to, as Jimmy was mentioning earlier, slower warbands. So I think there is benefit there without making it a bit too strong, maybe like Spectral Wings. I think Shining Example is a solid end phase card. As we were alluding to earlier, it's just really hard to score some end phase cards. We're kind of hard pressed. I mean, we're looking at catching up, you know? So I think I really, really liked Shining Example, and again, makes your leader all the more valuable. Which can have downsides if you know he or she gets assassinated. Other than that, I don't necessarily have a particular upgrade that I miss. Generally, I find the Nightfolt upgrades to just be superior, and I guess most of my decks were just almost entirely consisting of Nightfolt upgrades. So I actually don't really miss any of them.
Fair enough, Phil. What are your three?
So for objective, one that I think would be really interesting now that objective play has had a resurgence would be having Making a Statement come back. I think people would actually want to try for that now, in certain situations, and the reward is pretty high if you can pull it off. And with some more things for sort of playing objectives and moving them around, I think that could end up being really interesting, but alas, that card basically never saw the table. And then for a ploy, I'm torn. I'd really love to see Distraction come back, but I also understand why it's gone. I do miss that card dearly. And for one that I think is more palatable to be reprinted would be Improvisation. Having a way to quickly sort of refresh your hand if you needed to, mm-hmm. or if you just got to a situation where you already played all your cards, it was just nice to get a few more. So I liked some of the play that you had with that one. And I generally agree. I was struggling to find an upgrade that I would really like to see come back. I think most of them, I don't have a particularly strong feeling about them being gone. But if I had to choose one, I think Light Armor was interesting just because of the significant downside to having it. And so it was fun play for things like Reavers where you didn't care if your guys died anyway. And it kept it out of every deck because there were certain fighters that you just absolutely didn't want to take that risk on.
Sure.
And I like cards that have that good risk reward built in, where it's not an auto include. You really do need to think about this because it could be detrimental.
Fair. Strong reasoning. To your point about Distraction, I do miss it as well. The one thing I do appreciate is that it's had me going looking other places for Disruption. So Center of Attention has been something I've been using, and man, you feel like there's just some very interesting, and you can feel real clever if you pull something cool off with Center of Attention. That's been a fun card for me to implement just because there's unexpected ways that it can come into play.
One thing that I wanted to point out, Phil, is you said Improvisation. And I'm assuming that's because of the draw engine, right?
I mean, partially. But like I alluded to, there's, some situations where it's nice to have an outlet to get rid of a hand without doing a full mulligan. So maybe play the one card you want, and then you can cycle everything else.
Have you tried Frenzied Search?
I definitely plan to.
That card is awesome.
It's very similar. It just isn't quite as strong. But I definitely like that one too.
So, well, I really like it because you can just throw an upgrade away.
Right.
Because it says a power card, right? And then so technically you net one, but you can draw up to three. So why not draw all three? And then you have so many more options and hopefully more gambits to mess around with.
Yeah. No, for sure.
What I especially like about that card is how it was a little bit polarizing when yourself and some of the other creators that had their first review of the Grimwatch cards, some people were hot on it and some people were not. And that's the sign, I think, of a very interesting card where you have very good players going in different directions on whether they think it's good or not. So I think it's exciting, if nothing else, for that.
No, I'll admit I was cold on it at first, but after playing with it, it's real hot.
I know it always feels demoralizing from the other side because somebody with Frenzied Search, and then I see what they throw, I'm like, I don't care that they threw that away. That sucks. So, all right. We've been going for quite a while here. We are going to kind of crash through some of these other questions. We had a whole bunch of specific warband things, so we're going to kind of blitz through a few of those. Dominic Sarah was asking about Iron Skulls. Where do we think they stand? Aman, you had a thought on this.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, right? Because I think they're in a really weird spot where I think they can do well, but at the same time, like, LOL, they're Iron Skulls boys. So I know that someone recently won a 15-man event, and I apologize for whoever it is. I cannot remember your name, but I'm actually really fairly curious in how they did it. As I mentioned earlier, I think now is the best time to play with older warbands due to the limited card pool. So if you have strong stats that the Iron Skulls do have, or even faction cards, as we mentioned, there are some cunning but brutal ways in which they can move around the board and maybe have a good time. So I think you can really shine if you mess around with it and really lean into what your faction's good at.
Yeah, I think so. I'm sorry, I'm not going to have the name either. I was looking at it earlier, But yeah, I like you said, we covered some of the things that we are prioritizing. You know, even stuff as simple as having a good time. That's an extra attack on a 50-50 for, you know, for no particular positioning restriction or anything like that. So I 100% back Amon up on this. Is this is a time with a restricted pool where some of your cards are going to jump to the fore. Brandon Huss and Jonathan Lloyd were both asking about Sepulchral Guard. Where do we think they stand? I think I've played against them a few times. They lost some stuff. Some of the things they do, they still score. They still score. Keep them guessing pretty reliably. I think there's something there. And I guess you know when we're talking about these, I think you can get on your co-host website, Well of Power, Jonathan Davis, and he's got his stats right, and I think from the lowest to the highest warband, the difference in success ratio is 40% to 60%, right? What that says is that, you know, no one's losing all the time, right? So there's a route forward with them. Do you see anything with Sepulchral Guard that makes you say like, hey, let's keep an eye on these guys?
I think now we haven't actually seen it come up yet much. But I think some of the stuff where you can score objectives for holding objectives after an action rather than at the end of a phase is going to be really good for them, just because of how many fighters they can be moving around at once. Now, obviously, Thorns probably just do that better, but it's still a viable route for Sepulchral Guard, but we need to actually see those cards. And right now they don't have them, but I think it feels like that's sort of a direction that we're heading. And if they can even just have one or two of those, that could be enough to get them going. So I would maybe watch for that. But I think their base stats are still just, they were just ever so slightly too low. And I think that's holding them back a little bit.
Sure. More than anything, I'd say is speed, right? Speed too just feels oppressive, right? Mm-hmm.
So. Here's a thought, though, that I just had is maybe you can play them in a way in which it's like anti or deny objective. And I know you're probably thinking how, but like maybe they can cover the objectives and then, you know, you kind of go to town with the Harvester and the Champion. Mm-hmm. And the Harvester can get pretty accurate because like once you eliminate one of those fighters, right, the cool thing is that if you can bring them back via power card, they can just charge again.
Sure.
And yep. So you can really actually take advantage of maybe turning some of your guys into weapon caddies or just giving them, like, I don't know, cards that can just make them reliably hit or do a lot of damage. And I think there's a play there. I think it's a stretch maybe, but
yeah,
I wouldn't mind, you know, exploring that.
I mean, they have an in-faction distraction, right? Like that right there in and of itself makes them an interesting choice. You know, people are so used to just getting to be where they're at instead of having to worry about getting pushed off. So, yeah, I to your point, I agree. I think there's some interesting stuff there, and I think the loyalists, the diehards, may find a way forward with it. Kenny, our I don't know, should we call him our local nemesis?
Sure.
We faced him in the last couple little mini glass tournaments we've done. He was asking how to make Farstriders great again. I made a run with them for a while there. There's something there, but they man, it's hard work. 12 total wounds to start. The big thing I think working against them, they have some very interesting upgrades and very interesting power cards. They have Retaliation, which is an extra attack after they've been damaged, which you can occasionally combo with Aggressive Defense. So Aggressive Defense, I'm going to take an attack after this. And I didn't roll any defense dice, so he actually did damage me. So now I'm also going to play Retaliation. So I'm going to get two attacks, and then I'm going to take my turn for a third attack. Like there's some sweet combos in there, but their objectives is where they are really struggling right now. And with only three fighters, some of that flex play can be pretty challenging. I found because trying to spare the fighter to go stand on an objective can be tough. Now on the flip side, when you have a ranged attack, sometimes you can make stuff happen while standing on an objective. So that's where the route forward is. I was having mixed success. Aman, you got some thoughts on the Farstriders?
Yeah, man, it's sad to see them kind of not perform as well as they used to be. They were my first love in Underworlds, truly the first warband that I really enjoyed playing all the time. I guess that speaks to the power gamer inside me. But and prior to Great Concussion leaving the game, which feels so long ago, I think the fact that they could really isolate an opponent and then just gang up on them and whittle them down was one of their strengths. I think there is a case that maybe if we see some more Hunter cards, they could benefit from being a Hunter-style warband where maybe they can use both Pit Trap and Snare and Lethal Ward and Encroaching Shadows. I mean, the, what's it called, Falcon Strike or
Raptor Strike, yeah.
Raptor Strike, yeah, that card is just busted. So mm-hmm. they've got some of the tools. I think Archer's Focus coming back gives them hope. And I actually think that this conversation has now made me want to play them. So I'm going to try to figure it out. But I do agree that their objectives are weak. And even though Swift Capture and Path to Victory are almost auto-includes in every deck, as you mentioned, they have three fighters.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Sit on an objective or maybe just try to kill your opponent?
Yeah. They still, you know, the games that went well, I got Farstrider super upgraded. You know, he had whatever, Fighter's Ferocity and Glory Seeker, and he was sending his bird just exploding people, you know, all over the place. So it's not that they won't win any games. They're in there, but you it's going to take some work. So David had a question. He said he'd love an eventual relook at all the Shadespire warbands and how they perform with Shadespire universals rotated out. I think that's something we're going to hopefully circle back around to. That's something that I've been working on a little bit. And we've talked some about the cards that are out there. As we have more time in our recording schedule, I think we will jump back in and be taking a look at some of those. Chris wanted to know, are there any forgotten warbands that benefit from the restrictions? So is there anything you think that people have not been paying attention to that might actually be stepping up to the fore right now? Phil, you got any thoughts there?
I don't know if they're necessarily forgotten, but like Skaven, I think, are still very good and could still play very well with the restrictions. And then I think, and I haven't tested it yet, but I think Steelheart's Champions could still do fairly well. Although that might not play out as well on, I think on paper they looked like they'd still be pretty good, but I haven't tried anything with them yet. So I'd sort of have to see how that pans out.
How about you, Aman? Anything you think people might be sleeping on right now?
Yeah, I don't know about sleeping, but most certainly, I think, as we mentioned, the Guard have some massive potential, I think. I could be completely off, but I have a feeling that they can be played right now pretty decently. And then both the Khorne warbands, Reavers and Magors. I know that you found recent success with the Magors, and you know, I think, again, raw stats, they inspired a movement for, they hit pretty reliably and hard. And as much as I hate to promote any Reaver play, I'm just kidding.
Jimmy Molini. Yeah.
Shook the world there. Yeah. I think they do have the ability to deny the Grimwatch and inspire.
Yeah.
I think they have the movement to threaten anybody turn one. And as you mentioned earlier, they have some great faction cards.
Yeah.
And if you die or if they die, you still get Khorne Care's Nod and it begins.
Yeah.
Which is great. And then it can perhaps, maybe you play Hoarder with them. Who knows? But
I think you do.
I've been trying it. It's been working out. Like you keep pace because you do exactly that, where you've built up a little buffer of glory, then you get that Khorne Care's Nod, it begins. That gets you plus three more, and all of a sudden you're into Hoarder range, and you end up having like a six glory end phase or something like that. So they keep pace even as they start to whittle down. But and to your point, so you know, we talked about, and we're about to wrap up here, but I did spend some time with Magors, and I did that specifically because I was looking for a warband that could run into the Grimwatch's half of the board and be happy about being there. You know, if you look at Farstriders, they may not enjoy, you know, that's where they have to go to inspire, but they don't necessarily want to get swarmed. Magors are truly happy running in there, especially when you have someone like my number one all-time most the number one criminal,
Mr. Gary.
Yeah. Gartok. That ability to never be driven back, that's incredible in this game right now. It makes you immune to snare, it makes you immune to pit trap, it means you can stand your lethals. Like, that is humongous. And so that's been a very fun warband to try out. So take a look at that. I think a better deck builder than I could probably come up with something a little better, but even with what I've been able to put together, it's been a lot of fun, and you feel like you can hang with Grimwatch, which is pretty important. So I think we are about wrapped up on all that. That was a ton of questions. Anybody got anything else they want to throw out before we start to wind this down?
You know, I think the biggest thing, if you're playing Beastgrave right now, is to just play as many games as you can. Someone asked me on my blog earlier, you know, what can I do to get better? And I think this is a perfect platform to just explain is play more games and talk to as many people as you can, because every game you play, whether it's against an opponent that maybe not be on the same skill level as you or even better than you, you'll learn at least one thing.
Sure.
Furthermore, talk to people, right? Like, we have an amazing community. I think it's one of the best. I mean, look at us, right? Like, we're hanging out. We've become friends, and we've gone to events together. And I think the more conversations you have, the more things will come up and you'll learn. And maybe, like today, like, we just came up with some strategies ourselves. So,
yeah. Phil, any last thoughts here before we move on?
I guess just a reminder that nothing has settled yet in this shaken up meta, and don't be afraid to experiment. Get out there, do the crazy stuff. You know, we're always impressed by people who come up with something super out of the box, and it's like, whoa, where did that come from? And right now there's probably going to be a lot of that out there. So if you've think of something that you think it's like, this seems kind of crazy, maybe I shouldn't do it, just go for it. Like, nobody knows what's going to be great right now. So if you've got an idea, run with it. The worst case scenario is you try it out and you realize that, that was a dud. So I think this is sort of the fun time of trying to figure out what's going to be good, what's going to be the new it thing. So just have fun with it.
Yeah, if there's ever a time that your crazy idea was going to work, it's now. So do it. I think that's going to do it for us. We're as far as runtime, we're more Path to Glory than we are What the Hex at this point. it's all great conversation, and I'm looking forward to this getting out and getting the response. Before we outro, I just want to say a big thanks to you, Iman, for coming on. This was a great conversation, and we should definitely do it again. But if you want to get in touch with us, you can get us on Twitter at WTHcast or whatthehexcast@gmail.com. Iman, if someone's looking to get in touch with you, what's the best route they can do?
Yeah, so we have Path to Glory on Twitter, as well as Hexes and Warbands. And then, you know, I'm pretty responsive on the Hexes and Warbands Facebook page as well. So hit me up if you got any questions.
Yeah, and I'd strongly recommend Hexes and Warbands the next time you see a release. So I imagine the next thing we're going to see is Ripa's Snarlfangs will drop, those goblins on wolves. And if you want to get that first look, Hexes and Warbands is a good spot to go check it out and get a take on those cards while you're eagerly anticipating getting them into your hands. Well, obviously, thanks as always to everybody who's listening. Listener response was amazing. Thanks for all the questions. It kind of made the episode. I'm glad to. I know there's a couple we missed, and I apologize if we didn't address your specific question. But we're running along on time. If you want to check out all the other Mortal Realms content, Dogs of War Cry are going strong. That's another great skirmish game. Eric and his crew are making an incredible podcast over there. You can find all that stuff on themortalrealms.com. Your recommended listening for this episode is Alone and Forsaken. It's originally by Hank Williams, but you can check out any of the covers, Social Distortion, Nico Case, The Mekons, anything like that. For What the Hex, I've been Davey.
This is Phil.
This is Amon.
I'm already recording, so I'm going to get all this good stuff for all this
lovely
love.
Almost as good as Aaron's takes.
I'll tag it to the side and we'll see how we're doing on time if we sure. have a little bit of spare.
I'm also going to do my best to impersonate your sexy interview voice, so
oh man,
I'm going to try.
All right.
We did get a Redditor that left a comment that just was, "I love Davey's voice."
Oh, I love it too. Sometimes I just play games with him just to hear his voice.
All right, cool.